Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G. Because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.
Today on Not Sam Wrestling, he's here. It's finally happened. The Undertaker is really here for the first time in all the years of doing this. The Undertaker is on Not Sam Wrestling. I am interviewing The Undertaker. Plus, Backlash just happened. We'll talk about the greatest match ever and a whole lot more. This is Not Sam Wrestling.
This is Not Sam Wrestling.
Introducing your host from New York, here is Sam Roberts.
Oh, yeah. By the way, how about that voice, huh? The fact that that voice introduced this podcast can mean only one thing. This is the greatest wrestling podcast ever. People freaked out. They heard that voice last night at Backlash. Guess what? You can hear it here, too. Why? Greatest wrestling podcast ever. This is the greatest podcast. Welcome to Not Sam Wrestling. And this one will be. This one will be the greatest wrestling podcast ever. Because today I'm going to share with you my conversation with The Undertaker. The Undertaker is on the podcast. It's the interview that he did with myself and Jim Norton on Sirius XM. That interview now comes to the Not Sam Wrestling podcast, and that's today. But first, we have a lot to get off our chest about Backlash. I have not yet seen, by the way, episode 4 of The Last Ride, which premiered yesterday at the time of this podcast releasing. We had to wait a couple weeks between episode 3 and 4. I guess there's only 5 episodes, so there's only one episode left after this, which is soul-crushing to me. But there is something really nice. See, every other episode that I've watched within like 30 minutes of it even being released online. Every other episode I've watched like immediately, but just because of the way timing worked out, I didn't get a chance to watch episode 4 yet. And there is something, I probably could have made the time, but there is something wonderful feeling to me about the idea that I have an episode of The Last Ride in the can waiting for me, just waiting for me, that whenever I want to, I can turn the TV on. I mean, right now, thanks to Backlash, I have the 4th episode of The Last Ride and the 1st episode of 90 Day Fiancé, Happily Ever After, both just waiting for me to watch at my leisure. It is a great time to be the last professional broadcaster, Sam Roberts. Now, let's talk about Backlash. Let's talk about the pay-per-view that was, and I guess, most importantly, the main event of that pay-per-view. You know, for a second, about halfway through the show, they showed the graphic of Edge versus Randy Orton. And for a second, I thought, are they going to do this match? How could this be the greatest wrestling match ever and it be in the middle of the show? But it was just a tease. It was just a tease. As some of the great Not Samsonites in the Discord room were saying, what were they trying to do? Wet our beaks just a little bit? Is that what the phrase you guys used was? I don't remember. By the way, speaking of the Not Sam Shills, it was great to see the higher ranking Not Sam Shills from patreon.com/NotSamWrestling join me in a Zoom room, open up the Zoom room before the pay-per-view on Sunday. Those are always so much fun to do with the Shills. But let's talk about it. We witnessed it. After weeks of anticipation, after weeks and weeks of build, and some mockery, maybe, the greatest wrestling match ever. Now, look, I was the first one to talk about how absurd this description was. Literally, The podcast after the episode of Raw, when Charlie Caruso looked dead into the camera and said, well, if this happens, this could possibly be the greatest wrestling match ever. Complete mockery of the whole situation. I said, that was the weirdest way to end a show I've ever heard. It was a great promo. That interjection made absolutely no sense. Of course, it had nothing to do with Charlie Caruso. It had more to do with the fact that this is what WWE was doing. I was like, I don't know why WWE would decide to end the show on that line. Little did I know, they were billing this entire pay-per-view around this. Like, we all kind of take for granted, but it was only a handful of weeks ago. The just uttering the phrase was like, what? Nobody knew that this match was going to be billed as the greatest wrestling match ever, that this was going to be the advertising feature. And I made fun of it the whole way. I said, it's absurd. I figured you'd get out there, Randy Orton would hit him with some brass knuckles and roll him up, and it would be over. And all this hype around the greatest wrestling match ever would be for nothing. And that's why, because I said, how could they possibly live up to the greatest wrestling match ever? It's impossible. It is setting the standard so high that Edge and Randy Orton could never possibly meet it. However, I actually decided to watch the match. And I did what most people don't do. Well, I wouldn't say most people. I did what some people don't do. I actually watched the match with an open mind. I sat down saying, is this going to be the greatest wrestling match ever? No, of course it isn't. Of course it's not. I'm sitting here, I could list you 10 matches that it won't beat. But let's see what happens here. Let's see what they do. And it probably took me half the match to figure out what was actually going on. And I'm just going to say this, okay? If you watched Randy Orton versus Edge and you hated it, or you just thought it was, you didn't like it at all. I'm not saying you had to love it. I'm not saying you had to say this is the greatest match ever. But if you were like, this sucks, you might be stupid. You have to look into that. You might be stupid. I'm not saying you are, but you might be. It's possible. Think about it. A lot of stupid people don't realize they're stupid. You might be stupid. Very rarely in wrestling is something called nuance used. You don't see a lot of nuance in professional wrestling. It's just not an entertainment that lends itself to nuance. Usually, when something is being presented to us in professional wrestling, a mallet is used to thwap us on the side of the head with it. And when we look up, the message that we're supposed to get is imprinted on the side of the mallet. Okay? Subtlety is not something that is often used in professional wrestling. But the greatest wrestling match ever used both nuance and subtlety. Because without ever expressly saying it, the greatest wrestling match ever was not a description of the match. It was a concept. This was not a declaration. I saw it like a reply. I was like, well, I mean, I like that match, but that wasn't the greatest wrestling match ever. I've seen better. How do you still not get this after watching that match? It wasn't a description of the match. It was a concept. Greatest wrestling match ever is a concept. That is a concept that could theoretically, you could do, you know, whoever. You could do Drew McIntyre versus Bobby Lashley in a greatest wrestling match ever. You could do, you know, I don't know if it would work nearly as well. But you could do it for any number of people. Greatest wrestling match ever is a concept. And the concept is, let's use two athletes that we can trust. Two athletes that understand the art of professional wrestling better than just about anybody else on the roster. Two athletes that we can guarantee will deliver a great performance. And let's use them to celebrate wrestling. And let's use sounds. And let's use camera angles. And let's use visual cues. Let's do everything we can. Let's throw all this together in one match and just throw a party for professional wrestling. Let's put on a presentation that will call a match, but in reality is simply a celebration of this thing that we all love. And that is what the greatest wrestling match ever actually is. And they disguise it because the commentators treat it as if it's a wrestling match. And the fans in the audience are treating it as if it's a wrestling match. And, you know, it's not, it doesn't look so different from what we're used to, but it's just different enough. Because you couldn't make it look so different than what we're used to, because what we're used to is what we're celebrating. I mean, you're sitting there going, why was Charles Robinson dressed in a outfit from, you know, the late 80s, early 90s WWE, WWF referees? Because that's an era that we look back on nostalgically. It's the same reason Howard Finkel's voice was used in the ring introductions. Same reason that old school microphone was hanging from the rafters. The move sets that were the story that was told throughout the match. The story that was told throughout the match was not this story of Edge trying to get personal revenge against Randy Orton, or Randy Orton trying to gain his victory back that he didn't get at WrestleMania. The story that these two told was the story of professional wrestling. And the way they used pedigrees, and the way they used Eddie Guerrero's suplexes, and the way they used everything that they used. The amount of tribute that was in that match. It was because it was all just a giant celebration for professional wrestling. The camera angle from the top that we saw, I don't know if you guys remember. I remember it from WrestleMania 10. To me, that camera angle will always be synonymous with Bret Hart versus Owen Hart, the opening match for WrestleMania 10. But that was used because it's a celebration. It's like, oh, I remember that. Oh, I remember that. All these little visual and audible cues to make us go, how great is wrestling? Not to make us go, oh, man. Edge and Orton. This isn't about Edge and Orton. Edge and Orton are the players that are able to pull this off. Now, I said it could be anybody because it's a concept, right? Because greatest wrestling match ever is a concept. It couldn't actually be anyone because it takes a certain performer to be able to pull off this concept. But the concept is not unique to Randy Orton and Edge. The concept is unique to pro wrestling. And it's such a deep concept to me that you have to get people you can trust who understand what we're doing here. You know, I saw people online that were complaining about piped in noise as if the WWE was trying to pull the wool over people's eyes, as if we all weren't supposed to understand that that is not the sounds of the live crowd. The ring announcer that they used is no longer alive, okay? They announced before the match that they were using sound effects. Like, they announced it. It was as forthcoming as you could possibly be. You don't see sitcoms going out before a sitcom and saying, hey, just so everybody at home knows, these aren't really laughs you're hearing. This is a pre-taped laugh track. A sitcom would never say that, but WWE did. Because WWE was being completely forthcoming about what they were presenting. I thought that the pre-taped fan response, once it clicked into me what I was watching, added tremendously. In the beginning, you're like, that's weird that they're doing this. It's weird. Like, we know what this is. Why are they? And then it's like, oh, because this isn't just a match. Because the sounds of the crowd are part of pro wrestling. You can't celebrate pro wrestling without those big sounds of the crowd. And that's why those sounds were there. And none of them, by the way, none of those sounds were like, I mean, that's ridiculous. Nobody would be reacting like that. If they did this match in front of a live audience, like in front of an arena full of people, oh my God, people would be blowing their faces off because they couldn't believe what they had just seen. The fact that Edge and Orton, even with all this aside, were able to pull off the match that they were able to pull off in the conditions that they're in, we're in, the whole world is in right now, unbelievable. And the fact that Edge hasn't had a match. He had a street fight at WrestleMania. He was in the Royal Rumble. And before that, he had spent 9 years at home. And this is the performance that he's able to pull off. It's insane. It's insane. It doesn't happen. So, you know, I sat down to watch the match going, this is a ridiculous concept. This is not going to be the greatest wrestling match ever. I started watching going, I mean, you know, these guys are doing a great job. Randy Orton's bleeding. They're outside on the table. They're back in the ring. They're blah, blah, blah. Howard Finkel in the introduction. I'm like, I like what I'm seeing, but I still don't get it. And they'll get it. And then it clicked in what I was actually watching. And this is going to be one of those things that hindsight is 20/20 for people. I think that, you know, a lot of people were talking about this match. A lot of people were talking about this match on the internet. And I read a lot of people saying that they were going to go back and watch this match now. A lot of the casual wrestling fans, a lot of the wrestling fans that maybe don't watch everything, they were saying, okay, I keep hearing about this thing. I'm going to go back and watch this. I have the network. I pay my $10. I'm going to go back and watch it. And I think when they go back and watch it, because of all of us talking, I think it's going to be much more clear what it was. You know, I think history is going to look at this conversation that we're having right now and say, well, yeah, no duh, Sam. What do you mean it took you half the match to figure that out? But this is a reflection of watching the match live. And there's going to be a lot of people who sit there and pretend that they knew what was going on the whole time. But I hope that all those people have a record of what they were tweeting out at the first half of the match and the second half of the match. Because a lot of people changing their tunes when they realize, oh, maybe if I just given this a second to see what it was. You know, I was with the Not Sam Shills in the Zoom room before the pay-per-view. And I said to them, I said, I don't really care who wins, who loses. I haven't really thought about what this is going to be like. I just know that after weeks of buildup and the way they've been describing this thing and the music and the visuals, I want to see what this presentation is. This isn't just going to be, oh, this is just like all the other matches, but this one's really good. There has to be something different here. I want to see what it is. And I sat down and I watched it like that. And when I realized what it was, I was like, this is a genius concept. I said, this is really, really cool. This is for wrestling fans. We always get all up in arms when we think the WWE is doing something for the mainstream people. Every WrestleMania, everybody gets so upset.
Well, they only want Roman Reigns to win for the non-fans. They only want Roman Reigns to win for the mainstream people. What about us wrestling fans? What do we get? SummerSlam? It's not enough.
But then when they give us something, they go, okay, how about this? How about we put on a match? We call it the greatest wrestling match ever. We throw Edge and Randy Orton in, and we give you 45 minutes of everything you love in the world.
His crowd noise was stupid.
Okay. Whatever. Whatever. And there, by the way, if other organizations had put on a match exactly like this, certain people who might be negative on it would probably be pretty positive on it. Okay? Because to me, this match was a pretty high concept deal. And I thought they pulled it off exceptionally well for what it was. And this is going to be one of those things that forever, if you're a wrestling fan and you come up to me and you talk to me, I don't want to seem bigger than anybody. I don't want to seem better than anybody. This has nothing to do with, well, I'm on my own podcast. I got my own show. Nothing to do with that. I don't think I'm better than anybody because of anyone's job or where anybody is. I'll have conversations with everyone. I mean, sometimes I think I'm better than people when they come at me and they sound stupid. And I go, I can't do this. Then maybe yes. But that has nothing to do with where anybody's at in life. That has to do with, you know, brain development. That's all that is. If you come to me in the street and you tell me now, after seeing it, after seeing what that was, and you still have the opinion, I don't know if it was the greatest match ever, you missed it. It went way over your head. You missed it, and I'm not going to be the one to explain it to you. I looked at my Twitter, and I said, thank God I got my own wrestling podcast. Because I'm like, I want to reply to all these people that don't have a clue what they're talking about. And then I went, wait a minute. I can just rant and rave about it on my podcast. I got my own podcast. I got an interview with The Undertaker. I got a great podcast this week. I could start it off with a whole rant on this stuff. And so that's what this is. So that's where I land on the greatest match ever. I thought it was a pretty genius concept. I thought it was awesome. I see WWE front row. I'll definitely look at it differently, even though I enjoyed the hell out of it the first time after hearing the explanation. That's what it is, man. That's what it is. We're celebrating. Okay, it's a conceptual piece. It's performance art. Pro wrestling at its best is performance art. Okay, this was performance art at its highest. And I really enjoyed it. The more I think about it, and I also just get a kick out of these concepts. I get a kick out of the fact that this is the direction they decided to go in. I was on here ranting and raving about how if we're going to be stuck in the performance center, if we're going to be stuck in a situation where we got no way to perform in front of crowds, we can't do traditional wrestling in a non-traditional world. This is non-traditional wrestling. This is exactly what I was talking about. I thought it was wonderful. I really, really had a blast. As far as the rest of the pay-per-view goes, you know, it was what it was. The McIntyre-Lashley thing, it was like, I guess that they're going to wait until SummerSlam to give McIntyre a different opponent. So it was a hold-off. They'll get to do a rematch now, and it will further the Lana storyline. So, you know, it was what it was. Didn't do much for McIntyre. Strowman versus Miz and Morrison didn't really do anything for anybody. It was, you know, I'm glad Strowman won because he should look like a powerhouse, but it was what it was. Asuka and Nia Jax, you know, I wouldn't say it didn't do anything for anybody. I would say, like, I wouldn't tell somebody, oh, you got to go back and watch this thing. But at least it allows Nia Jax to remain in that main event position. She could continue to piss off people that think she's injuring everybody. And I think Asuka might be in the same boat as Drew McIntyre. I think Asuka's next big opponent is probably going to be SummerSlam. We got Extreme Rules, which is neon green all of a sudden, which I just love. That Extreme Rules went from outdated late 90s Extreme to early 90s Mountain Dew, California Bro, Cowabunga Extreme. I love that they went back in time. I think it's awesome because now early 90s is like super hip. Look, I love the movie Rad. I drink, you know, Mountain Dew at Taco Bell every time I go. So I'm all for it. But I think, you know, you got McIntyre versus Bob Lashley sticking around for Extreme Rules. You got Asuka versus Nia Jax sticking around for Extreme Rules. Jeff Hardy and Sheamus was what it was. You know, the tag team title, triple threat. It's good that Bayley and Sasha kept the titles because they've only had the titles for a couple weeks. And we're going to keep, again, I would imagine SummerSlam would be the time that you'd finally have the mega powers explode and have Bayley versus Sasha Banks. Maybe around Extreme Rules is when they split. Apollo versus Andrade on the kickoff. The right guy won. And the other controversial moment of Backlash. The Viking Raiders versus the Street Profits, or what it was. It turned out to just be a giant skit. And I'll tell you, to me, very interesting. I have not been a tremendous fan of the Viking Raiders Street Profits skits that are happening on Raw. For the most part, I think they've been dumb. And, you know, I think that you could use both teams much better than the skits. I can't hate them for trying. As I said, there should be more of that entertainment stuff going on. But, yeah, it's not something, I don't sit there on a Monday night and go, oh, God, I wonder what the Street Profits and the Viking Raiders are going to be, what sport they're going to be doing. Now, maybe there's a 10-year-old watching that is getting a kick out of it. But if there's a 10-year-old watching, I'm going to be like, it's 10:15 on a school night. Go to bed. And he's going to be like, hey, old man, it's summer vacation. If it's too loud, you're too old. And I'm going to go like, all right, well, I guess I've aged out then. What can I tell you, kid? But I think that I'm watching it, and the beginning part, I'm like, oh, come on. I'm just not into it. I was not into the first half of the Viking Raiders versus the Street Profits. And I say I was just not into the first half because that all changed. Maybe it's just the effort that gets put in. Maybe it's because I did go on a kick this weekend watching like old 80s horror action, low budget kind of exploitation movies. And this is what that felt like to me. And I absolutely loved it. Maybe it's because I like it when they put like extra effort into what they're doing, when it's not just like, okay, we'll go and shoot at this place. Like when they actually are going like, okay, let's put some big production elements into it. When they've really kind of broken the piggy bank to go like, let's have this look big. Everything in that match changed for me when Tozawa showed up with his gang of ninja bikers. When the ninja bikers showed up, I was like, I had this feeling. Like, I didn't want to like it. I wanted to hate it. And the ninja bikers showed up, and I go, oh my God, I'm having a great time. Oh my God, I love this. Oh my God, this is great. I completely changed. And then the Viking Raiders and the Street Profits team up and become the Viking Profits, I believe. And Stat Guy Greg from Cheap Heat had a great tweet. He said, I think it was Stat Guy Greg. He said, did they not realize that the Street Raiders would have been a better name? I was like, that's a great SGG, you nailed that one, buddy. But I loved it. I loved it. I thought the fight scene was so stupid and so much fun and so great. And then they go in the trash thing, and then the referee comes out, and then she says the one Viking is cute. I like that he's like the sexy one. I think that's funny. And then I swear, I was like, I was just not on the same level as some of these other people. Maybe I'm not on that Bruce Pritchard wacky tabacky. I don't know what's going on. These ideas are being formed. But I love that these ideas are being informed. I love that these ideas are being created. I love that these ideas are being spawned. You know, I love that I'm sitting there, right? And the garbage truck that they're in or whatever, the dumpster starts moving. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is cute. I guess they're going to get taken out, you know, and go to the dumpster. Oh, no, we're getting thrown in a garbage truck. Like, that's cute. And they're like, nope, trash monster. I'm like, yes. Now, they'll tell you probably, no, it was an alligator. We're in Florida, and that was obviously an alligator tail. You could tell me that all you want. I read that as trash monster. And I was already in, like, I'm watching, and I'm like, okay, wrestlers and Vikings versus ninjas. We are clearly in a low-budget 80s exploitation movie. What would a low-budget 80s exploitation movie do to end the scene? Trash monster. Obviously, trash monster. Somebody was like, that was hot garbage. I was like, the only reason the garbage was hot is because of that trash monster's breath. I thought it was awesome. I loved the end. I thought it was entertaining. And maybe I'm a shill for it, but they won me over. That one, if you didn't like that one, I don't think you're stupid. It's just not your cup of tea. That I'm fine with. That one, I am absolutely fine. Anybody that says they didn't like that one, okay, that's cool. You know, I could see where opinions would split on Trash Monster versus the Viking Raiders versus the Street Profits. But for me, if you like the stuff that I'm into, you probably got a kick out of it. Sorry to interrupt, guys, but you know, it's your fault that you're dealing with these interruptions. You wouldn't have to deal with interruptions. You could even get the podcast a day early if you were a Not Sam Shill. That's right, Not Sam Shills at patreon.com/NotSamWrestling. Get the show early and ad-free every single week, and they get a bonus podcast every Thursday. Thursday, Not Sam Thursday comes out exclusively for the Not Sam Shills. You can get it all, including exclusive access to our Discord room, where Not Sam Shills are talking wrestling 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All of that can be yours at less than $1 a week. But there's so much more going on at the Not Sam Wrestling Patreon page. For instance, did you know, before Backlash this weekend, a bunch of us went in the Zoom room. That's right, there was a Zoom meeting between myself and some of the higher ranking Not Sam shows where we just talked about the pay-per-view and everything going on in wrestling. You can get access to the video that we put out before anybody else. You can watch these podcasts be recorded live from the Not Sam studio every week, and so much more. If you're a real fan of this show, if you want to go all the way, if you want to commit, and if you want to support everything that is Not Sam Wrestling, become a shill. Everybody else is at patreon.com/NotSamWrestling. Speaking of stuff that you're going to get a kick out of, that was Backlash. Very special episode of the podcast today. I kind of wish this were happening 5 weeks down the road. So this were episode 300. If we don't have a 300th episode spectacular, understand that this counts. Because this is the guest that I've been waiting to get on forever. When I started this podcast, 5 years ago or more at this point, long time ago, I had already interviewed a ton of wrestlers. In the 5 years since the podcast has been on or more, I don't remember, I've interviewed just about every wrestler you could imagine. For maybe not for hours. I would love to go back and interview a lot of these guys again and sit down with them for hours and do like what we did with Matt Cardona, with Zack Ryder last week. Spend an hour, hour and a half, and just kind of go down the career. But I've interviewed everybody. I've sat in Stone Cold Steve Austin's living room and interviewed him. I've interviewed Shawn Michaels. I've interviewed Triple H. I've interviewed Hulk Hogan. I've interviewed the Ultimate Warrior, God rest his soul. I've interviewed Vince McMahon. I've interviewed The Rock. I've interviewed everybody. You know, I never got a chance to talk to Macho Man Randy Savage before he passed away, but I've interviewed Bret Hart. I've interviewed Rey Mysterio. You know, I don't know Ric Flair. You know, I don't know who you could put on that list that I haven't talked to on some level for at least a couple minutes. The only person whose name never made it to that list was The Undertaker. And there was a part of me that had gotten to this place where I was like, okay with the fact that I would simply never interview him. I've said hello to him a couple of times since I've worked at WWE, but that's truly it. And when I say hello, I don't even mean like, hey man, it's great to meet you, I'm a fan. It's just, hey, how are you? Hello, nice to meet you, and move on. That's it. So no interaction really, nothing memorable certainly. But this Last Ride docuseries changed everything. This was a guy who had never done interviews. And the only time he had, you know, he did Regis and Kathy Lee in character. When he was American Badass, he did Jimmy Kimmel. A little bit more recently, he had popped up and done interviews with like his church. But nothing that I could make the argument, hey man, he's doing interviews. Like, let me talk to him. It wasn't until he officially broke character for the first time on a global scale when episode 1 of The Last Ride was released that he started doing real interviews. And I would watch him do some of these interviews, and some of them it made me cringe. Some of them, like, I was crying on the inside because I'd listen to these interviews and they were just like, let's just ask the basics. You know, I just watched the documentary. Let me ask about the documentary. And I'm like, do you understand what's in front of you? Do you understand the opportunity that's being presented to you by your ability to have a recorded conversation with the legend of all legends, with the GOAT, with The Undertaker? You don't. And then there were a couple of interviews that he did where they actually asked real wrestling questions. And I listened to The Undertaker answer these questions. And I listened to the way he was just so candid and he was telling these stories. And it made me want to interview him even more. When I realized, like, yeah, he loves talking about wrestling. His career is what he knows. And I'm like, yes, yes. And, you know, I started getting in touch with I've been in touch with WWE PR over the years. I made it very clear that this was my great white whale, that this was the interview that I wanted. And should it ever come up, you know, for years, I said, should it ever come up, please put my name on the list. As soon as the docuseries started, as soon as he started doing interviews, text started being sent to WWE PR. Hey, you know, I know he's out there doing press. I know it's a long shot, but please, if you can squeeze me in, if there's any room, if it's something he wants to do, whatever you got to do, I am putting my request in. Okay, gotcha. And that's, I mean, that was, again, that was when the first episode premiered. So, you know, there were back and forths over the course of several weeks. Yeah, we're trying. Yeah. And then it was like, don't worry about it. You know, we are doing promotion for The Last Ride throughout the run of the series, not just one big batch in the beginning. And then, and I was like, okay, well, that's good news. And finally it happened. And I got the text and I was like, look, whatever. I'd love to have him on the show on Sirius. If he wants to, doesn't want to wake up, he wants to pre-tape it in the afternoon. If The Undertaker wants to do an interview at 3 a.m., say the word. I'll be down in my studio at 3 a.m., whatever he wants to do. No. We'll get him on the show. We'll get him on Sirius. I was like, this is amazing. So last Monday, I had the opportunity. I didn't believe it was going to happen until it actually happened, until I saw the man's face pop up in that Zoom window, and The Undertaker was there. He was on the show with myself and Jim Norton. Of course, Jim and I host the morning show on SiriusXM 103 every morning starting at 7 a.m. Eastern. We talk about everything. We talk about the world at large. Talk about the stuff going on in our lives. Talk about the stuff going on in the news. Talk about pop culture. We have guests on. We have comedians. We have actors. We have musicians. And every now and then, and we've had wrestlers on too. We've had Kane on very recently. Triple H has been on, the Bellas have been on, you know, lots of wrestlers. Drew McIntyre's been on, Seth Rollins, Roman Reigns. But every now and then, one of the greatest legends of all time, virtually through Zoom, knocks on our door. And it is always our privilege to let him in. This is a big one, guys. This is a special one. Here he is. For the first time on Not Sam Wrestling, all credit due and all thanks to SiriusXM and to Jim Norton and Sam Roberts Show for the audio and the opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, The Undertaker.
The Not Sam Wrestling interview.
Well, welcome, man. First of all, how has this whole process been for you? It's been 30 years of getting to live in the character as far as the public goes. You know, you've done very, almost no press, but I mean, beyond that, not even doing stuff out of character. Nobody's gotten to know you at all as far as the wrestling community goes, you know, outside of the inner circle. For people to kind of see you as Mark Calloway, is that a weird thing?
It's been very weird. And, you know, I've actually, it's been a process, because a lot of times, especially early on in this deal, I still found myself being guarded. Like, you know, I can't, like, I'd want to start to talk, and then I'm like, wait a minute, I don't know if that's, I should say that. And then I'd have, you know, then I'd have to process it all in my head. And I'm like, no, this is your idea. This is, you wanted to do this. So, you know, let it go. And then, because I've always been that guy, it's like I'm the last of the kayfabe guys, right? Like I'm just, yeah, you know, protect everything at all cost. And I'd be the one in the, you know, when I'd hear somebody else talking about the inner workings of the business or anything like that, I'm the guy in the back going, ugh, just pulling my hair out. And now I'm that guy. So it's taken a little bit of time to kind of get used to that. And, but I'm, you know, it's, obviously now it's starting to get a little easier, and we're kind of starting to scratch the different layers of who the Undertaker and Mark Calloway and how they fit together. And
yeah,
do the fans like it, or do they get like, is it hard for them to see you out of character, or are they comfortable with it?
You know, it's funny. Most everything has been very positive, and like, you know, people are just, because they've been dying for years to kind of, for me to lift the veil up and see what's going on. And, but then there's always, you know, there's always the one or two people that are like, my childhood is dead, you know, because yeah. I finally, you know, Or if I did something on social media or whatever, it's like, The Undertaker's on social media. My childhood is a waste. I mean, come on, man. Cut me some slack, will you?
But that is a lot of responsibility for you to live up to.
What's that?
That's a lot of responsibility for you to live up to, that you're not just doing this for you anymore. Like, you are responsible for the childhoods of tens and hundreds of thousands of now 30-year-old men that are looking at you.
Exactly. Oh my goodness.
So the first live show that I ever went to was at Wembley Stadium. It was 1992. It was SummerSlam. And that was the show that you came to the ring in a hearse.
Right.
In front of 90,000 people. A couple of things, like, now that I think about that, there are a couple of things about that that are mind-boggling to me. Number one, that you were in your 20s when you were doing that. So you're a kid going through all that. And number two, that you'd really only been in, you'd been in WWE less than 2 years at that point and already felt like, oh, well, that's The Undertaker. He's a staple of this whole thing. What was that like for you at that time to go through?
It was just it was utterly amazing to see that many people. And then coupled with the fact that it was in the UK too, I was still like in that whole world of so many things were being exposed to me, and, you know, things were on such a bigger stage, grander stage. But just, I remember on that, riding on that hearse on the way to the ring, it's just like all you could see were people. And, obviously at that point in my career, that was, that was, 30, 40,000 more people than I'd ever worked in front of at that point. And it was like, wow, this is pretty damn cool, man. And then trying to obviously stay in character and not be not trying to show any emotion or any, how excited I was,
that's the part that I've always wondered. What's the worry? Is it that you're going to, on your face, crack a smile or like look up and not be the Undertaker for a second? Or is it that, oh my God, I hope I don't stumble walking out of this hearse because it ruins the whole thing?
I think probably the stumbles were always more of a, because that character is so calculated and so stoic. It's just like, and you know, because everybody is just like, they're mesmerized and what, because I move so slow and it's just like, what's he going to do? And yeah, if I stump my toe and, do the trip run kind of thing, it's over. It's like, oh man, he's just like us. But fortunately, I didn't have too many of those through the years. But that was always one of the things that I was thinking about. When I locked in, especially early on, when I really felt like I had a grasp of the character, I don't think anybody could make me smile or break character. But every once in a while, something might jump up and trip you.
What's it like the first time you walk out as a character? Is there a fear the very first time you walk out in any character that people won't like it or they won't respond to it? What is that like?
Yeah, it was pretty nerve-wracking because I had spent, 8, almost 9 months in WCW. So people had, they'd seen me. And then I had a fairly good break before I started with WWE. But you're always kind of like, you got this really strong character and it's new and it's on WWF at the time, so obviously you're nervous because it's your debut being with a new company and you've got all this behind you and, you don't want to be sitting there listening to, hey, that's me, Mark, it's just like, come on. But it was nerve-wracking for sure.
When did you realize that the position that you were in that company, or when did you really get into that position? Right. Because I mean, clearly Vince McMahon had a fondness for that character from the very beginning. I mean, from the huge debut to the fact that you had a victory over Hogan within a year of you being there. But, there are all these stories of Vince liking something and then, kind of getting tired of it or it not panning out like he thought he would or whatever. And he loses interest. and that's it. It's goodbye. When did you realize, no, I'm a staple here. This is my position. I'm one of the top people forever.
Yeah, it was. I still didn't have that feeling when I beat Hogan. I knew I was coming up, but I wasn't there yet. I was still kind of like, all right, I'm just doing what I'm told, and you know, hopefully this thing keeps developing. It was probably about the time I did the angle I did with Jake. That was probably when I felt like, okay, we have something here. And there was a large, you know, there was a large movement to turn that character babyface.
Right.
That was done. The audience, you know, our fans did that. You know, they didn't have any, I don't think anybody, when they originally thought of that character, ever thought of it turning babyface. I mean, it was just too dark and too macabre, especially for the time that we were doing it. And then, you know, next thing you know, I'm getting cheered, and it was just like, man, this is a sick world out here.
Do you worry at all before you turn babyface in that first year when, I mean, you're skyrocketed, like the first big angle you have is with Warrior, and then you have the angle with Hogan, and it's like you're working with the top people from the very beginning. Does it ever occur to you, if I don't become a good guy, I'm running out of top good guys to work with. If I don't become a good guy, where does this character go after Hogan's done and Warrior's done? The only place to go is down, right?
Yeah, you have to think like that. But at the time, I wish, you know, I didn't dwell on it too much. But we had a, you know, there was still a pretty good influx of talent coming in and going out. Obviously, Hogan and Warrior were 1 and 2 on the totem pole. You know, I knew there were legs there, but I didn't get too overly concerned. Now, probably if I knew what I knew now, then I would have probably been a little bit like, okay, that's the top two guys, where we heading?
Right.
But obviously, you know, there were guys like Jake and that was a perfect, you know, darkness, you know, Jake was a dark character. And so, you know, sometimes ignorance is bliss, because you can't worry about too much. But it is what it is, and it worked out all right, I guess.
Early on, did you ever worry about getting caught doing un-Undertaker things, like in like the fans, like you know, they, you know, you're crying at a Julia Roberts movie or whatever it is that you're doing that doesn't fit, and you have to worry about them seeing you doing that?
Absolutely, man. I don't think anybody ever caught me crying at the Julia Roberts movie, but
that's just my own example. For you.
I think I kept my sunglasses on for that. no, but yeah, but like I said, I live this character. Like, I mean, I was Undertaker 24/7. So I was always cognizant of, you know, what are you doing? How are you, you know, how are you moving? And it's just like, it's like, oh man, you know, I don't want somebody, you know, seeing me going and ordering a smoothie, or, you know, I was like, you know, it was a lot easier back then, obviously, because there was no, you know, there wasn't cell phones and everything you did wasn't being recorded. You know, nowadays there's just, you know, there's just no way you can do it anymore. But back then it was a little easier, and my focus, you know, I knew what I wanted to do. I had this mindset of, you know, this is what people are going to see. So, you know, I mean, I actually thought, like, I would be in my hotel room thinking about, okay, this is how you need to be when you're going through the airport. This is what you need to be at the rent-a-car place. And, you know, if we did any outside media, like, okay, I got to let Paul Bearer, you know, he's got to do the gist of the talking, and, you know, I'm just there to make people uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because like even when you look back at photos that have now come out, because everything's on the internet now, and you look at photos of like you hanging out with the boys in that era, and you're backstage and you're on a bus or whatever, it's a photo from somebody's private photo album, but you still even in that photo that no fan would ever see, you have this element of the character. You're in all black. You got the hair down. You got the shades on. Like, there is still, it still looks like you're the Undertaker. How long, yeah. How long would a person have to be around before they kind of got to know you backstage?
Well, I made a point early on, like our crew and our roadies, everybody. I mean, I always made a point to, you know, go up and say hello to them. Mm-hmm. But before they, you know, before they got to the back of the bus and the European tours, which I think is one of the pictures you're referencing, it took a long time before I felt comfortable letting anybody back there. You know, I mean, it was just because that is a little point, even though I still look like, that's kind of where you let your guard down and you kind of let that, you know, you take that deep breath and exhale and you know, you have a moment with your friends and your peers. But I really had to, you know, I had to trust people. And most of those guys understood what I was trying to do. And, you know, and they all, you know, I can't say that there's really anybody that was like, well, I'm going to try and expose him for this or that. You know, they understood the importance of the character, and most, you know, everybody obviously wanted to, you know, they wanted to do angles anyway. So it was,
right.
You know, but I was pretty guarded pretty yeah. most of the time, but I wasn't like, you know, I didn't, you know, I wasn't like, if, you know, some rigger came by, you know, I wasn't like, hello, you know, I mean, no. Yeah, I was like, hey, how are you? You know, you doing okay? But I mean, I always felt like it's important to treat people, you know, treat people the way you want to be treated. But
that is the difference,
right? It just became understood that, okay, this is how he is. And, you know.
Isn't this easier, less pressure? Isn't this easier at this point?
It's much easier. And, you know, even Michelle now will tell me, he's like, I kind of liked it more when you didn't talk so much. It was like, it's like, I got 30 years built up inside of me. I got to get it out.
Yeah. You went through this period of time. It's pretty long. It's most of your career, I think, where I think you were viewed as so dependable in WWE, and a person that would not only always be there, but would always deliver on a certain level, that you started getting every opponent thrown at you that whether they could wrestle or not, if they look like a monster, it would be like a guy would come in and be an Undertaker opponent. We were talking about this before you came on about how, you know, you ended up having to drag 8-foot guys through WrestleMania matches and having you had your orbital socket broken by 600-pound man dropping his leg on your face. Did you get to a place where you were like, look, Vince, I appreciate that you think I'm dependable, but please, please let me work with some of these guys that know what they're doing.
Oh yeah, man. I begged him all the time. I was just like, and it was funny because I knew like when somebody would come in, it'd be like, even before I got the, you know, the call into his office, I knew like, yeah, he's headed my way. Yeah. You know, I remember you mentioning 8-foot, which was obviously Giant Gonzalez.
Yes.
I tried to tell this story really quickly. I remember he came in about the same time that Yokozuna came in.
Mm-hmm.
And I had known Yoko from Japan and seen him work over there as Kokina, Maximus. And I just like, I was always just enthralled and amazed by how good a worker he was and how well he moved for the size he was. And anyway, he was doing a dark match. He had signed, but he was doing a dark match. I think we were in Baltimore. And so there's a stage there in Baltimore that you can go out and you can kind of peek through the curtain and watch and no one sees you. And so I see Vince standing there and he's watching Yoko work. And I come stand next to Vince and we're both watching him and just, you know, watching some of the stuff that he's doing, these kicks that he's throwing and how agile he moved at 400 pounds. And I remember stopping and turning my head and looking at Vince, and I was like, please, 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 please let me work with him first. And, you know, Vince, and it's Vince laugh. Oh, you'll work with him in time, but I got somebody else in mind for you. And I kid you not, coming down the hall from the other direction, here comes Giant Gonzalez, right? He goes, that's your guy. And I was just like, oh, because I got a little bit of taste of Giant Gonzalez when we were in WCW together, right?
Right.
And I think that might have been another reason why I left, because they were trying to get me in a program down there. And
yeah, but you didn't realize all that Giant Gonzalez needed was a full bodysuit with fur in all the
hair
right places,
patches.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My, that was the worst. So, that was the hideous, man. It was so bad on so many levels.
So
but
when
I
you
got him first, so
you did. You got him first, and you get through your match at WrestleMania 9, and you're like, okay, I did it. We got through it. It was a WrestleMania match, and we did it, and it was big, and it's over, and we are good. When you find out we're doing it again at SummerSlam, do you go, what do I have to do?
Man, I tell you what, that whole thing took years off my career. I mean, I would be in much better shape now if I could have skipped that one program. It was as physically demanding as it was. Mm-hmm. It was twice the mental strain, because you know, you got guys out, you know. You got Brett's there, and now Yoko's there. All these guys are going out and having these great matches, and obviously you want to be mentioned in the same breath with those guys. And it was just not possible. It was survival every night, trying to figure out what he could do, and it took me to because at that time I didn't sell a lot and bump around and. But man, I was flopping and, you know, just trying to, you know, I was trying to make chicken salad out of chicken crap. And it was, it did help me, and it prepared me later on for being able to work with people, obviously.
With but, literally anyone.
Whew,
yeah.
I still at sometimes that point wake it, up with cold sweats.
Yeah. That's gotta be number one. You feel like you can literally work with anyone. And number two, when you finally do start having these matches that people are like, that's the greatest wrestling match of all time, you're going, well, yeah, I earned the right to have that match, okay? Do you know what I had to go through to get here?
No doubt, man. it was, after a while, like, you know, because you work that gimmick and then you really, it was always about the gimmick, really. And mm-hmm. So it really didn't matter who he plugged in against it. It was me working the gimmick, and then obviously, you know, choke slams and doing all that. But when I finally got a taste, and I think it was, I want to say it was Bret Hart was one of the first guys that I got to work with. You know, and Bret didn't really want to, you know, he didn't really want to change his style too much to kind of cater to the Undertaker character. So it was my first chance really to actually work. Mm-hmm. And then I had to figure out, okay, now can you work the gimmick and then work a wrestling match? And,
right.
I had some really, really good matches with Bret that I'm really proud of. Where that kind of started becoming, that was kind of where I started getting more better talent. And then obviously that went into the early Shawn Michaels stuff. And I was like, yeah, this is pretty cool. And so
it
was
funny
when I was young, and really healthy, I wasn't taking a lot of bumps. And as I got older, more beat up, the more bumps I took, and I had the whole thing mixed up. I did it backwards.
That's when you're starting to do planches and stuff like that. You're like, now that I've gotten beat up a little bit, let me throw some lucha in here.
Yeah, right? Like, what the heck am I thinking?
Did you have any hideous ideas? Like, before you actually found this character, were there any hideous ideas that you're like, oh, God, thank God, that never took off?
Well, only the one that I created in my head. So I'm sure you probably have heard the story of Eggman by now. But no, so, no. So when Vince did the, he did the buildup about the time that I debuted at Survivor Series in 90, you know, they had the buildup for the giant egg on set and they were building up and I had convinced myself without anybody saying a word to me that I was going to be coming out of that egg and that I'd be Eggman. Like, and I was at that point where I was trying to let my hair grow out and, you know, I was working on my look and all that other stuff. And this is even before Undertaker was even ever had breath, you know, breathed into it. So there's this egg on the set every week. Right. And I'm at home like watching. I'm like, oh, I'm going to come out of that egg. I know it. It's going to be me. I'm going to come out of that egg. He's going to make me shave my head and I'm going to have to shave my eyebrows and I'm going to be Eggman. And I was honestly working myself up into a nervous panic. And finally one day the phone rang and I got up because we didn't have cell phones. I got up, went to answer the phone and it was like, I was like, hello. And he goes, is this the Undertaker? And I'm like, Undertaker's not Eggman. And it took me a second to realize it was Vince, right? And I was like, that's Vince. It ain't Eggman. Yes, sir. This is the Undertaker. Yeah. I just knew it wasn't. Honestly, I honestly about give myself an ulcer worrying about becoming Eggman. Fortunately, that wasn't the plan. That was the gobbledygooker. The gobbledygooker was in the egg.
And believe it or not, the Undertaker seemed to have more legs than the gobbledygooker character. I don't know who would have called it, but the Undertaker had legs.
The gobbledygooker got served up later that night. I think. He got carved up.
One of the, things that makes you is you're the one guy who stuck around. You're the guy who consistently was with WWE from 1990 until now. You're really the only person that can say that you were that person. I mean, Sean never went to WCW, but he was gone for a period of time. The fact that you never went to WCW, though, is a pretty big deal because everybody went to WCW. Was there any point in your entire run, especially as hot as WCW was getting with the NWO, with Hulk Hogan, with all that stuff, did it cross your mind? Was there a moment where you were like, you know, I'm closer now than I have been?
Yeah, there was a time. Like, I was so frustrated. I was so frustrated with our creative direction. Like, we had a bunch of really goofy characters and then they're down there doing some really, like, you know, real angles and, you know, it was common knowledge that they basically opened up the checkbook and, you know, and I'm having to hear guys, you know, talking about the money that they're making. And I'm like, my gosh, you know, you'd be able to write a pretty good check and stay at home most of the time. And so those thoughts were there, but when it really got down to it, you know, I said, I can't. Obviously, I'm not the best businessman, but you know, there's just something inside of me that said, you can't leave here. And then there's a couple of things. One, when I was there, and although the management had changed at this point, while I was there, I went in to renegotiate a contract. I'd been there for 8 or 9 months. My deal was coming up. And I was just going in, trying to get a little bit of bump in the money, right? I was on the bare minimum deal. Wasn't looking to break the house, but I go in and meet with Jim Herd, Ole Anderson, and Jim Barnett. Went there downtown in Atlanta. I go in and, you know, they're thinking, well, we're going to re-sign you to the same deal. And I was like, well, I've had a pretty good, you know, I've had a good, pretty good year here as far as where I was on the card and everything. And I was like, I was hoping to get a little bit of a bump in pay. They looked at me straight in the eyes and said, son, I go, you're a great athlete, but no one will ever pay money to see you wrestle. Huh? So let that just sit in the room. Right. I'm like,
right.
Wow. Okay. Now what do you do? Like, on the inside, like I knew right then, like my days here are numbered because I have a ceiling, you know, they've already capped me out at what I can do and who I can be here. And then, fortunately I got the meeting with Vince. And as soon as I got the meeting with Vince, I was like, okay, well, I got this meeting with Vince. They'll hire me straight away. So I give my notice just on the meeting. I go have the meeting with Vince. At the end of the meeting, he goes, well, and it was at the house. It was at his house too, right? So I go have this meeting, and at the end of the meeting, he goes, well, we don't really have anything for you right now. I was like, okay. Didn't plan on that one either.
Yeah. It's like you broke up with a girl before you had a new girlfriend.
So, yeah. I just like, wow, this is not going real well at the time. But obviously Vince eventually calls me and he's like, look, I'm going to give you an opportunity to do something. And that by him giving me the opportunity and after what the other guys had said to me, I was just like, this is, obviously. And then, Undertaker happened and we're off and running. I was just like, I can't leave. I just, my loyalty to him for giving me that opportunity was more than, the short-term cash-in that I could have done by going back down to WCW. So
was that motivating or crushing when they started? Was that motivating or crushing when they said, no one will pay to see you wrestle? Is there a party that goes like, God, they're right? Or is there a party that goes, screw these guys, I'll show them?
No, I mean, it was a definite hit to my pride for sure. But at that point, I was locked in. I knew that this was what I was going to do. And like, I had that passion bug and it just like, okay. I just knew my days there were numbered.
Right.
I didn't ever second guess myself as like, I need to get a new job or go back to school. It was like, okay, I got to make some moves. But it was always fuel. It really was always fuel. I never forgot it. Obviously, I'm bringing it up 30 plus years later.
Yeah.
But I've always, I've always had that in my back of my mind, like, no one will ever pay to see you wrestle.
I love that you'll go from, yeah, exactly, because 7 years later, they're literally putting an inflatable version of you outside of arenas so they can tell the world, hey, guess who's in here? I thought it was interesting. We were talking about, like, people that were brought in to be your opponent, right? To be the next monster that The Undertaker has to conquer. And you were also talking about that kind of goofy era and how it got to the point where you're like, what are we doing here creatively? And I actually think that for you, what brought your character kind of out of that goofy territory and let's do Undertaker versus Undertaker, let's do Undertaker versus Giant Gonzalez, let's do Undertaker, I think it was Mick Foley being brought in. And I think the Undertaker Mankind feud, which, if Mick Foley wasn't Mick Foley, could have just been another somebody being brought in for the Undertaker to compete with, changed, I feel like, both of you guys forever. Do you think I'm right about that? And do you have a favorite Mick Foley match?
Man, you're dead on with that. And so I knew we had worked a little bit together in WCW. It was Cactus Jack. So, I knew what Mick was about, and I knew him as a little bit as a person. And then, just kind of like, I always had confidence that was going to work. And, but you're right. It had the potential to be a stinker, because his character, if he hadn't have done his character so well.
Right.
That was the thing. You had a bunch of guys doing silly characters that they didn't have a clue how to work. They didn't want to be working these characters, but he embraced Mankind and made it his own. And it allowed us to do things, as far as violence and physicality that people hadn't really ever seen. So it was a breath of fresh air to me. And, I think that was a very pivotal part in the Undertaker lore, was the whole Mankind angle. And man, I there's so much stuff that we did, you know, the Boiler Room Brawl and Hell in a Cell. And
yeah, I mean, when you think about it, it's like the Boiler Room Brawl is what made it so that you and Paul Bearer weren't connected anymore. And then when you come back at Survivor Series, that's when you've shed kind of the purple and black cartoon Undertaker that we know. And that's when the all black and the leather and the teardrop and all that stuff. And I feel like that's really the evolution of the character. But like, speaking of Hell in a Cell, right? You've got this guy, you're wrestling. The Hell in a Cell is probably, I mean, it's, to me, I believe it's the most famous wrestling match for non-wrestling fans. Everybody knows, you know, about that match. There's a folklore behind it. You're wrestling that match with a broken foot. You've already thrown Mick Foley off the thing. He's crashed through the table. We knew this was going to happen. When there's that moment when he goes through the cell, which was not supposed to happen, he hits that ring. And really, at that point, only you and him know how badly that's going to hurt. Most of the fans at home are still like, oh, it's like a trampoline, that wrestling ring. They don't know that it's like hitting concrete. And the chair hits him on the way down and everything. And you at that point realize that the crowd doesn't know that something's gone horribly wrong and your friend is hurt for sure. And you're sitting now on top of this structure and you don't know what to do. What's going through your head?
I was trying to focus and hope that he can move. Because that was really close to being catastrophic. It really was. And, you know, he'd already taken the bump off the top. And although that, you know, although that was planned, that was no easy. I mean, it's just not easy to do. And it ain't easy on the body. And then this happens and he landed, man, he landed in such a funky way. You know, I didn't know that he was going to get up. And so, you know, I'm having to think like, okay, I need to get down there for one, and check on him. But, man, I was legit scared for what, you know, what the results were going to be. He's just a tough son of a gun, man. I don't, you know, most people don't get up from that. Like he did. I mean, you know, get up and finish the match. And I'm trying to talk to him, and I'm like, Mick, let's go home. All he wanted to do, he said, we got to get to the tax. I'm like, are you shitting me? Really? I mean, I'm looking at his, you know, I had no idea what it was at the time, but his tooth went through his lip, and got ended up lodged in his nostril, right? And you could look in his eyes and tell you there was nobody home, but he knew that he had to get to the thumbtacks, and that was the finish. And I was pleading with him, just like, man, Mick, can we go home? Because, you know, you could just tell that, you know, he was not there. And tough dude, man. Really, honestly, I don't know if there's anybody, you know, any tougher or anybody else that would have the, I don't know, sense of responsibility to even try and finish that match.
Well, we got to wrap you. This has been awesome. I mean, this is, you know, as Jim knows, I've interviewed just about every professional wrestler on the planet, and you are every time anybody's ever asked, who's the one guy that you haven't interviewed, who's the one guy you'd like to interview, Undertaker is always the name. And now you've crossed that name off the list. So we really both appreciate you being on the show. I appreciate the last ride. The docuseries is incredible. Episode 4 premieres on the WWE Network on Sunday. And real quick, I'm watching episode 3. I think it was episode 3. And you're talking about the relationship with Shawn and Triple H. And you're talking about the moment that you guys had at WrestleMania after the second match with Triple H. And the moment that the three of you have on that stage. And this docuseries is kind of about you chasing what is the moment that is going to cap off your career. Is there any part of you that is worried, wait a minute, maybe that was the moment?
Yeah, obviously, because that moment was organic. It wasn't planned. it really was just something that happened, you know, after that. Like I said, that angle was 4 years in the bill, you know, two with Sean, two with him, and it ends up with all three of us up there at the top of the stage. And yeah, no, you can kind of, you know, look in my eyes, and I'm looking around even while we're up there, and I'm enjoying the moment that I had with these two guys, which I hold the utmost respect for. But I'm also looking around like, does it get any better than this, right? You know, does it get any better?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we know I kept going, but it was definitely one of those moments. And then I had the moment with the second match with Sean, like,
yeah,
because you have to, you know, I'm looking down the road like, okay, who else is left that I can have this kind of match with anyway? You know, I mean, there's not a lot of Shawn Michaels. I mean, there's some really good talent, but there's not a lot of Shawn Michaels and Triple H's out there left. And, but just, you know, for whatever reason, I kept rolling and here we are. So, but that's one of the most special moments of my career, is being on stage with those three guys at the end of, you know, of an all out in our profession, a war.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before we let you go, one question. Would you be open to the idea of you and I hanging out just to upset Sam?
Yeah, I got no problem with that.
Okay, great.
It would upset me greatly.
Yeah, it would really hurt him.
Thank you, man. Really appreciate the time.
Guys, thanks. And I apologize again for being a little late, man.
No, it's fine. It was great talking to you.
No worries. Yeah, awesome.
All right, man. It's nice talking to you guys. Y'all have a good day.
All right, have a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Follow at Not Sam on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube.
Rate, review, and subscribe. This has been Not Sam Wrestling.
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G, because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.